Hello, Amherst friends and family. I'm Mary Beth Meehan, class of 89, and I have the great pleasure of talking today with my old dear friend and roommate, Ellen Whalen Smith, class of 89, about a new book she has just published with the University of Chicago entitled The Angel in the Marketplace, Ad Woman Jean Wade Rinlob and the Selling of America. And so welcome, Ellen. So good to see you.
Mary Beth, it's so good to see your face.
Ellen, this yes. book focuses on a Madison Avenue career woman at mid-century, and there's so much in here that I know you've been interested in for a long time, but I'm wondering if you could talk about how you found Jean Wade Rinlob and what interested you about her.
Right. So, well, my first book that came out in 2016 was about the Oneida community. The Oneida community was a radical, free love, socialist, Christian utopia in upstate New York that also happened to be founded by my great, great, great grandparents. So that book was sort of a mixture of history, cultural history, but also family history. In any case, they were interesting to me because after they had sort of played out their religious role as an intentional community, and after the community broke up, they had been manufacturing silverware as a way of keeping themselves alive financially. And so they just sort of spun around and became Oneida silversmiths, which over the course of the 20th century was, you know, the sort of premier silverware company in America and a sort of shorthand for bourgeois, you know, domestic propriety and respectability, quite a far cry from their free love origins. But so how I found Rinlob was that she, during the war, during World War II, Oneida reached out to Barton, Batten, Durstein, and Osborne. I always forget the four names, BBD&O, the Madison Avenue mega firm. In order to do wartime ads for their silverware. And Jean Rinlob, who was working for them at the time, this was in 1941, 42, was tapped with the account. And what she created was this, you know, very sort of sentimental, heart-tugging copy in which picturing sort of absent soldiers coming home and, you know, greeting their sweethearts with a big embrace and a kiss. And of course, the sweetheart woman had a prepared dinner using Oneida silverware, ready and waiting for her man. And the tagline was "Back home for keeps." So it was very sort of sentimental, very kind of cloying, and you know, sort of playing on domestic themes. And so it turned out that she Jean Rinlob, her daughter, had recently donated all of her papers to the Schlesinger Library at Radcliffe, at the Radcliffe Institute at Harvard. And so, you know, out of curiosity, I went and investigated her archive, and it's actually quite voluminous. It's, you know, something like 51 cartons of papers. She saved sort of everything that she ever did professionally. So that's how I found her. And that is how I got interested in writing. What interested me about her was the way in which she sort of was a catalyst in the 1940s and 50s for not only, she marketed, you know, everything from soap to cakes to silverware to American housewives, but she also played a really important role in sort of consolidating a certain political and economic status quo at mid-century, which was sort of free market, small government, what was called at the time free enterprise or the American business system. And I was interested in the way that she was brought in to sort of market not only products, corporate products and manufacturing products to women, but also this sort of larger vision of what America is and was.
That's one of the things that really struck me about the book was that it's not just a biography of her, but it's as though she's stepping through the whole century, and through her story, you're able to talk about really broadly about capitalism, domesticity, consumerism, and these notions of patriotism. again, that I know have interested you for a long time. And I'm wondering, and also the mass media, I'm wondering if you could, religion, you know, the evolution of religious thought in the US. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about the, some of those themes and how her story pulls those together for you.
What I really try to follow, this sort of bigger story that I try to follow through Jean Rinlaub's life and work is the story of how, as a country, we imagined the relationship between the economy and the state or the government, right? And I think, you know, sort of today, it's pretty clear that the neoliberal small government free market ideology is going strong and is, you know, perhaps sort of the dominant model. But what was interesting to me is that it wasn't always the dominant model. There were at least two ways of thinking about how the state and the economy should interact. You know, up until the crash in 1929, there was a pretty robust support for this free market model that was evolving with corporations as sort of these entrusted leaders who, you know, would look out for everybody's interests. And the idea was that you got a robust market working, and it was a growth creator and a wealth creator. And it was a, you know, it was going to, if you just left the market to its own devices, it would be a, you know, a rising tide that would float all boats. That illusion was shattered in 1929. And what you got in reaction to it was FDR and the New Deal and the idea that the state, in fact, the market didn't regulate itself in the interests of everyone, and that the state often had to come in and provide to, you know, to provide a sort of guiding hand and to make sure that the market worked in certain ways and worked more equitably and fairly, right? So what happens sort of in the, what happens once the FDR and this sort of new activist state comes in is that, the, you know, the manufacturing and the corporate sector revolt, at least a large part of them do, because they see this as necessarily sort of stepping on their toes and you know, regulating in a way that, that might be adversarial. And so from really the 1930s through the post-war period, you have this strong sort of conglomerate of institutions, corporations, advertising agencies, and the media, right? Sort of working in tandem with the ad agencies being the kind of middlemen between the corporations and the, at this point, print and radio, right? Sort of getting the products and the advertisements out to the larger population. And they really try to sort of consolidate an idea of an average American, which ends up being sort of a white middle-class male American, and also the holding aloft this ideal of the sort of freedom, the free market as the American way, right? That only a free market will reliably work and reliably sort of protect freedoms and equality. So these two sort of systems are, you know, in conflict with each other, with, you know, advertising industries and the corporations, and to some extent the media, media as well, sort of gunning for a free enterprise model, and the forces for, again, sort of a, what today we would call big government, or, you know, sort of a government more regulation, you know, the government or the state taking a more regulating hand in the economy, sort of losing out, especially post-World War II. And so what I see, the interest I see in Jean Wade Rinlaub's story is the way in which she was able to use gender and appeals to, you know, a very traditional sort of model of femininity, of domestic femininity, in order not just to, you know, help her clients sell cakes and soap and silverware, but also to shore up this very sort of idealized image of who America was, which was, you know, a sort of, the sort of land of the free, home of the brave, all resting atop of the free market system. So it's what one advertiser, or what one writer who writes about the role of advertising during the war called the ad behind the ad. In other words, you know, advertisers like BBDO and Rinlaub were turning out ads for Betty Crocker or for Oneida Silverware for particular manufacturers or for particular corporations. But what they were really selling was the free market system, right? This was what the corporations and the ad industry, and again, to some extent, the media themselves were sort of were interested in shoring up, in addition to sort of, you know, individual products.
One of the things that I loved about this book was how she, the role of gender in so many threads. And not only is she a woman within this very male dominated environment, trying to attract women into the marketplace and create new products for them, create new consumers out of them,
right,
but also how women themselves, you start in the 19th century with women as activists, and you talk about how this free market system is trying to draw women out of their activist roles by kind of confusing them with thinking that the cakes and the dinners are going to save the world. But in right. fact, it's sort of the Chomsky idea that if you keep them consuming, they won't notice what's right. crumbling around them. So right. can you talk a little bit about that? I know the role of women in this whole century has been of interest to you.
Yes. Right. Yeah, I do in the book go into a history of sort of 19th century feminism and 19th century women's activism. So, right, in the 19th century, you have, you know, in the Victorian period, this sort of idealization of the woman as the angel of the house, right?
Is that where the title came from?
Where the title comes from, right? The angel in the house meant in the, you know, sort of mid 19th century, that the woman was the sort of master of her home, of her domus, and that she was supposed to be the man. It was at this point that we sort of came up with the idea of, you know, the public sphere versus the private sphere, right? Where the men were supposed to go out and sort of earn their hard-earned money in the marketplace, which was this place of sort of competition and rugged individualism, and it could get kind of sort of nasty and morally dubious. And so the house, the home with the woman as angel sort of presiding over it, was like a moderating influence, right? So the man had to do what he had to do to make his living out in the rough and tumble world, but at least at home in this domestic space, sort of Christian values and love and tenderness and you know, and goodness and kindness still reigned, you know, through the figurehead of the mother. So women's role really became identified with this caretaking, maternal, sort of Christianized vision that would work as a counterweight to the marketplace. But then what happened is some women who were justly bored at home, just, you know, sort of cooking and cleaning, and being an angel, decided, well, we don't just have to be angels in the home. We don't just have to be caretakers in the home. We can be community caretakers. So in other words, you know, the purview of woman as this moral force is not just her domestic family, her private domestic family, but the public world. And so, you know, in the 19th century, you have all of these social changes taking place, you know, massive immigration with the growth of and industrialization with the growth of a very poor and underserved immigrant urban class, right? And so you have women saying, look, no one's going to sort of, no one's going to make these social problems go away unless we as women, you know, in our capacity as angels and moral forces, go out there and do it. So you have these women like Jane Addams in the late 19th century going into Chicago, going into the tenements and trying to organize and make a better life for poor people. And she's doing it in partnership with the state. She's saying private charity is not going to solve these community problems, right? It's going to have to be, the government is going to have to step in and help regulate these problems. So from the beginning, you have at least a certain class of women in the 19th century arguing that yes, they're still being maternal, they're still being feminine because they're only doing caretaking, they're just doing it on a larger public scale. And this is sort of works. People kind of buy that, yes, you know, a woman in public, as long as she's doing it in the name of, you know, sort of social betterment or helping the poor, or helping the weak, that works. But then what you get with in the 20th century, as you know, the national markets get established and consumption, you know, nationally advertised and circulated goods sort of gets up and going, is that women are now told, and Jean Rinlum had a hand in doing this, that they you know, yes, public action is fine, right? Going out and sort of helping the poor and the weak and the orphan is fine, but you can actually be more of a woman and a better woman if you just stay home and make good purchasing decisions. That your role as a woman is to make good market decisions, to buy, you know, by purchasing, you are keeping this engine, this free market capitalist national engine up and going. And then that is eventually going to be, you know, the wealth producer that will make everybody equal and everybody, you know, comfortable, right? And so you have this massive sort of privatization of the woman's role. And what Jean Rindlob was doing essentially was telling women that they, you know, by staying home, by baking cookies, by buying silverware, by creating this, you know, this wonderful loving home for their own private family, they weren't abdicating their duty to be responsible community caretakers. They were just exercising it in a different channel, right? That by buying, by putting dollars back into the economy, they were helping to build this American free enterprise system that was going to, you know, sort of float the whole country.
Sort of like going shopping after 9/11.
Right. Sort of boost, put dollars back into the economy. And it was a very, you know, simplistic idea, essentially trickle down, right? That the, you know, the more you buy, the more money you put in consumers' hands, the more they buy, the more we produce, the bigger, the more the economy grows. And that this is eventually going to trickle down to all sort of tiers of the system. And, you know, we know today that that doesn't work. Or, you know, there's a pretty strong sort of evidential argument that doesn't work. But it's a useful way of siphoning off criticism of a system, right? A capitalist system that can be unfair and unequal, siphoning off that criticism away from, you know, actual sort of political and public action and into private purchasing, and just saying, you know, if you just have to wait long enough and the system will work. You have to trust in the free market engine. It will work. And you just have to sort of keep quiet and keep buying until that happens.
It's sort of ironic that she, as a woman who had this rare role within this very male Madison Avenue industry, would then be siphoning the women off, as you're saying, siphoning the potential activists into this domestic sphere of purchasing.
Right.
But she really mines that role intentionally and successfully, and really becomes a figure for using the psychology of the woman to get new consumers and to create new products. But she has an evolution by the end of the book. Can you talk about that a little bit, or is that giving away the?
No, not at all. Yeah. I think, right. She always saw herself, even in her, you know, she had this very sort of powerful role on Madison Avenue, and was kind of a tastemaker, and was really respected by not only people within the advertising industry, but the corporations with which she worked. But she always had to temper that sort of power, you know, that power broker role with the caveat that she was only doing it in the service of America's housewives. So, you know, anytime people tried to sort of congratulate her on being this this sort of corporate titan, she would say, that's not why I do it. I don't do it for the money. I don't do it for the fame or the power. I do it because I want to be of service to America's housewives. And service at this point was sort of a coded word that meant, you know, basically doing for others, right? Never doing for yourself. And so in that way, she kept herself sort of on the right side of the feminine equation, right? That women were never supposed to be, to do anything in terms of a career if it were solely self-serving, right? It was always had to be in some way sort of funneled back into that angel in the house paradigm that they were doing it for others. And she really believed that she was helping women sort of cope and make better decisions and make happier homes and, you know, get better nutrition for their kids, all of these things. But and what I think what's interesting is that also the whole time she was doing this, she also had her own family, two kids and a husband. And she, of course, also had a live-in nanny because she was gone most of the time. And so That's also always an interesting piece in these stories of, you know, powerhouse women who can have it all, right? They have the career and they have the family. Well, they can't have the family unless they have like a surrogate mother home taking care of things. And she, in this case, she had, it was an aunt, I think her father's sister or her mother's sister, who moved in with them and basically, you know, was sort of like a wife. But she, you know, she really bought into this idea that she was helping housewives and that she was helping America, that she was helping build a stronger America, an America where sort of freedoms, you know, whether it be religious freedoms or political freedoms or consumer freedoms were protected. And that eventually this was all in, you know, this was all going to build towards a much kinder, more equitable system. And then what happens when she retires is that she gets involved in sort of more almost 19th century throwback women's organizations, right? So these women's organizations that, again, are still doing this kind of 19th century, old fashioned 19th century caretaking of advocating for the poor, for the sick, for the disadvantaged. And she begins to realize as she's doing this, it also coincides with the civil rights movement. So she's getting involved in the March on Washington, which also corresponded with the Poor People's March, right? Organized by Martin Luther King. This is in 1963. And so the sort of twin problems of racial inequality and economic inequality are highlighted. And she actually goes to Washington in 1963, you know, as part of this kind of very bourgeois white woman activism, but she begins to see that her model, which was, you know, always based on a sort of ideal white middle-class subject, right, doesn't take into consideration sort of vast swaths of the population and doesn't take into consideration the systemic ways in which, you know, the free market is not going to do it. So this actually, this in addition to sending her daughter to Radcliffe, so her daughter went to a private school and then went to Radcliffe and, as was fairly typical in the 1950s, got married while she was an undergraduate and had a child right out of undergraduate, I believe, but then decided she wanted to go to grad school in anthropology and found herself in a really tough place because she had a family and how was she supposed to be a student and a full-time student and a full-time mother. And I think this actually revolutionized Jean's thinking as well, that suddenly she realized, you know, the women staying home, A, it's not that fulfilling. You know, here's my daughter who doesn't want to do it full time. She wants to have something outside of it. And B, it's impossible if, you know, all the caretaking falls to the woman, right? So she really has sort of a change of heart and ends up in, again, after she retires, working, helping women's activists. She actually writes some copy for the ERA in the attempt to pass the Equal Rights Amendment in the 1970s, which is really striking because all throughout her time in Madison Avenue, she poo-pooed the idea that women were given, you know, second class status. She said, oh, you know, if you're not moving up the ladder as a woman, it's because you don't want to, because you're lazy, because you're not working hard enough, because you're choosing your home over your career. You know, if you want it all, you can have it. So she comes around to the realization, no, this isn't true, that the, you know, discrimination in the workplace is real and that women should have recourse against it. And I think, you know, most importantly, she begins to see that this sort of idealistic idea that just by buying into, you know, just by being good consumers, we're going to revolutionize the world and make things equal. She realizes that's not going to happen.
I have two more questions. Are we good, Carly? Want to do thumbs up in the chat? Ellen, yes. Do you think it's important to point out, or do you think it's important to really name that when we're talking about women relative to this book and to her life, we're talking about white women. Okay. We're talking about white women of a certain class and buying power. I mean, you want to talk about that a little bit, or do you think that that's understood?
No, I don't think it's understood. And I think, you know, when I went into this book, I initially thought, well, this sort of not having, you know, gone through the archive and just having sort of a sense of what I'd find there, I thought, you know, the scoop will be sort of trying to tally how she became this corporate sort of professional powerhouse, how she tallied that with convincing millions of housewives to stay home and be happy baking cakes, right? And, you know, the deeper I got into it, the more I discovered and this is something that probably should have been obvious to me going in, but wasn't exactly, how white her audience was, and white, not just by sort of omission, but white by design. That, you know, a lot of what the advertising industry during this time relied upon in terms of coming up with marketing campaigns and scoping out new markets, it relied on opinion polls and research done by corporate research instruments. And they almost always only polled white middle-class subjects. And they even had a term for people who sort of fell outside of that white middle-class range. They called them unreachables. And that meant that they were difficult to reach. They sometimes didn't have telephones, or they didn't have addresses, or if, you know, a white researcher pollster walked up to a Black person's house and knocked on the door, they weren't likely to invite them in and answer questions. So it really was an all white world. And again, by design. I think this is also something that she realized, again, once she sort of joined into the civil rights movement in 1963, it suddenly became apparent to her that all of her sort of preaching about the, you know, the gospel of the free market and the way in which this was a way forward, a progressive mechanism for sort of raising all fortunes. She recognized how, without saying it, she never says this directly, but I think it's pretty clear she recognized how white, how myopic that viewpoint was.
I was so struck by the marketing with the cakes and the you know, that the soldier is going to come back to this well-lit home and this yummy cake and this lovely bride and reap the benefits of the GI Bill to build this American middle class, for which is not available to the Black soldiers coming back and exactly. Not available to such a huge part of the country. So exactly. It's such an interesting decision that she made, or maybe it was just so part of the culture, as we know, to just not see outside one's own whiteness.
I think it was part of the culture. And she actually has, you know, in one of her later, and this is in the late 1950s, she was doing work for Campbell's Soup. And at this point, the sort of idea of doing social issue advertising, you know, sort of using advertising in order to sort of back particular, you know, it was basically a way for corporations to make themselves look useful and ethical in the face of criticism. She actually, in doing advertisements for Campbell's Soup in the late 50s, floated this idea, well, why don't we have, you know, an advertisement that says soup is good for everyone and have a multiracial cast of children eating soup. And it was shot down. They said, that's too, you know, we're just not going to go there. I think, you know, she herself at this point, I think, was getting interested in questions of, you know, racial justice and so forth. And she saw a way of possibly sort of working it in, trying to get a more, you know, diverse representation, diverse faces in advertising. And it was absolutely not something that the firm was interested in doing.
So my last question is so much about this book. I loved it so much. And I felt like by reading it, you were explaining to me so much about how we got to this current moment. And a lot of it was depressing. And a lot of it was sort of, made me feel hopeful that this pendulum can swing back and forth, and it can swing back into thinking that possibly the free market, the trickle-down ideas are not working. Mm-hmm. And the ways in which the branding of certain responses, you know, certain objections to how things are functioning in our country are now branded as unpatriotic and therefore dismissed, no matter how rooted in truth they might be. Right. That this branding, that this role of the advertising industry in connection with the government and in connection with the free market is really pushing us to think a certain way and really trying to marginalize people who are trying to critique, mm-hmm. Trying to critique the system the way it works. And so, right. I really felt like this work helped me understand where we are in this moment. And I'm wondering if you could talk about that, if that was something in the back of your mind, or if this exploration for you, you know, led you to new insights about the now.
Right. Yeah. I think as I was writing the book, it was always informed by my sense of the now. In fact, I wrote an article about right on the eve of Donald Trump's election in 2016, about the sort of unholy alliance between business and Christianity and Donald Trump, right?
And where was that article published, Ellie? Let's make sure
it was published in the New Republic. And
cool.
Yeah, it came out. I think it was in.
We'll link to it.
February 2017. Anyway, it was, you know, looking at how this sort of tight narrative linking patriotism, free market faith, and, you know, sort of neoliberal, you know, individualist reading, you know, small government, all of the sort of trilogy of values had really come to a head in Donald Trump. And, you know, of course, we're just 4 years later, that much sort of deeper into that paradigm, right? So, I think, you know, I'm heartened to hear that you took that you were encouraged that, you know, the moment that we're in now, it's not new, right? We've been here before. There's a long history of, again, this sort of push and pull between free market dogma, you know, dogmatism, and a more you know, a larger role for the state in sort of regulating the hand of the market and making sure that it functions more equally. You know, I don't think that story's over. I think we're in a particularly bad place right now, you know, ever since, basically since Reagan onwards. I mean, the dismantling of regulation, dismantling of the unions, all of these sort of institutions and things that worked as a check on, you know, the free market sort of spinning the money ever upwards into sort of an oligarchic class. All of these things have disappeared over the last 40 years or been attenuated over the last 40 years. I think we are sort of in a nadir from my perspective, but I don't think that it's over. And I think if we can sort of reclaim the dirty word of socialism, I mean, anytime anybody suggests that, you know, the state should have a regulatory hand, or that, you know, the state should in some way again step in and have a bigger partnership with there should be a bigger sort of private public coordination of the market and of economics, people immediately cry socialism or communism. You know, this goes back 100 years. This was exactly what was being bandied about in 1917 on the, you know, in the wake of the Bolshevik Revolution. So what's funny, and to some extent, is how little we've moved on. That the same scare tactics, the same sort of bogeymen, the same sort of ideological specters are still haunting us. Maybe we'll finally break through that.
Well, I think this is such a wonderful book, and I hope our Amherst friends and family will run right out and get it.